Tiny Talk, Episode 2. In this episode, Mush Language Systems, Interview with Brazil, and a visit to Intermush. Welcome to Tiny Talk, a podcast about mushes and other text-based virtual worlds. I'm your host, Javelin, and this episode focuses on language in mushing. Natural languages, not the programming kind. We're going to look at three different language topics: soft-coded language systems for role-playing mushes, the new Unicode support in the TinyMux server, and using Mush as a vehicle for teaching and learning language. In many role-playing settings, characters come from different cultures, and language forms an important basis of cultural difference. By providing a language system, an RP Mush provides another means by which a character can identify with their culture and with other characters from the same culture. And at the same time, they also provide a means for allied characters to speak without outsiders understanding them. So if you think about the importance of the Chukobsa battle language in Dune or Klingon in Star Trek milieu, you get a sense of the function of language in terms of keeping out the outsiders as well. Mush language systems vary in their complexity. A very basic system, one that I'm sure many of us have seen, sort of sends the speaker's words to all the others in the room who know the language, and shows the speakers, the listeners who don't know the language, some random gibberish. More sophisticated systems make some effort to do other things. Three kinds of other things that they often do include partial fluency. That is, some speakers and listeners may only understand the language partially, so some of the message comes through and some of it doesn't. Language learning, the ability for players to teach each other better language skills. And speaker-specific accents. So some speakers may have characteristic ways of speaking that flavor all their utterances. This could involve sound changes, different pronunciations of vowels, for example, or changes where stresses are placed in words. If you have a language system that denotes stress in some fashion, either with accent marks or all capitals or whatever. And these kind of speaker-specific accents may be individual, but may also be regional or cultural. So maybe all humans who try to speak Klingon have a characteristic human accent. In that case, the variation is probably physiological, different tongues, but you get the idea. One interesting area for building language systems that hasn't received a lot of attention is modeling language comprehension with real linguistic principles. For example, human accents and mispronunciations are not really arbitrary. Certain kinds of sound features of one's native language tend to get overlaid onto the spoken language. For example, if you take a language which doesn't have a native F, as in Frank, sound, like Tagalog, which is the national language of the Philippines, it's natural to swap the F sound and the P as in Pali sound when you're speaking a language that does have both sounds, like English. In a role-playing mush, where there are a limited number of languages, it would be quite feasible to consider, for each language, how a native speaker of that language would pronounce each of the other languages. And modeling this would add a new dimension to the intrigue aspect. A sharp-eared character, or their sharp-eyed player, could do a kind of Sherlock Holmes thing and discern someone's background based on how they speak. I guess that's more of a Henry Higgins thing than a Sherlock Holmes thing. And that's just phonetics. So linguistics is much broader than just phonetics, and think about what you could do if you could model morphology, characteristic errors made by less than fluent speakers in their choice of words or other meaningful syllable units, or syntax or grammar, word order, for example. With a grammar parser, you could replace constructions that sound natural to us in English, like John's dog, with more labored constructions typical of someone who's learned the language from a different native background, with the different grammars, like a dog of John, which might be typical for someone who speaks Hebrew, for example. You might want some hard code support for that, but even a parser on the level of, say, the famous ELIZA program could probably pull off some of that. And then there's semantics. We have some common metaphors in English for very basic things. Great emotion, for example, is understood as heat. So we get the fires of passion, the heat of the moment, the pressure of anger, and so forth. The linguist George Lakoff has done a lot of really interesting work on conceptual metaphor, and there'll be a link to some of his books in the show notes. So that's really sensible, that metaphor, anger as heat or emotion as heat for people, because when we're worked up, we flush, and we're only really cold when we're dead. Now, if you had a race of snowmen, they might express great emotion in a very different way. Has anyone not seen the Star Trek Next Generation episode Darmok? Some people call it Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. It's episode 2 in season 5, back in 1991, and Captain Picard is trying to communicate with a people whose language is primarily metaphorical and based on their history and mythology epics. And the person he's communicating with, the alien, keeps repeating the phrase Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, which expresses the idea that by facing a common enemy, people become friends, because that's what Darmok and Jalad did at Tanagra in their mythology. Of course, players can choose the way they express things, and great role players will often maintain distinctive ways of speaking for their characters as part of establishing the identity of the character. Is it too much for someone to try to capture more of that in a coded language system? I'd like to hear what you think, so post your comments on the blog, send me email, or record a voicemail at 206-666-5114 and let me know. Stephen Dennis, better known to many as Brazil, is the developer and maintainer of the TinyMux server. That's MUX. The latest alpha release, TinyMux 2.7.0.4 alpha, is the first MUSH server to support Unicode, a standard for representing all of the world's languages' characters. Brazil and I spoke about the implications of Unicode in MUSH. So what is Unicode?
Well, Unicode's goal is to define a single digital form for all languages in common use. So it is a large, never-ending episodic standard. It includes complexities which are mostly unnecessary for American English, but which are required to support all languages together. The central thing to understand in Unicode is how they have defined code points, distinctly from bytes and characters. For example, in ASCII, the number 65 corresponds to the capital letter A. There is also only one capital letter A in the character set, and it occupies the 65th position. Fetching the letter A from computer memory is simple because every character fits into exactly one byte of memory. Every character occupies the same space. There are also simple relationships between capital letters and small letters. Ordering letters alphabetically in the same or almost the same as encoding those letters. For Unicode, these can be true, but none of them are necessarily true. A Unicode string is still a sequence of code points, and Unicode has defined tens of thousands of code points. However, a code point may correspond to more than one character, as we see with ligatures, or a character with accents may require several code points to express.
For the people who don't know, those ligatures are like the AE symbol.
Right, AE, OF, and when you get into some of the other countries, there are more of them. So there's so many code points, there are almost 100,000, that they need 3 bytes to represent them, although most of the common ones are held in 2 bytes, and the ASCII-compatible ones only require 1. So 4 is a useful round number, but that's very space wasteful. Most schemes use a variable byte method, either UTF-8 or UTF-16. Most of the platforms use UTF-16, and that's been around the longest time. It also has the advantage that Japanese characters occupy less space in UTF-16 than the alternative, which is UTF-8. But mostly Unix and the internet favor UTF-8 for some reason. It's byte-oriented. It has some nice properties like self-synchronization, and you can tell how long the sequence is by looking at the first byte. Transforms that we take for granted in ASCII become very interesting in Unicode. Uppercasing and lowercasing a string can not only change its length, but also add and remove code points. And that is locale specific. There, in some locales, certain code points are added and removed, and other locales are not. So there are many duplicate ways of expressing the same character, and Unicode had to add a normalization method so that we could tell which strings were equal, or compare them, sort them, those kinds of things. So ASCII is just a character set, and it's one we know and love. It's very simple. The full Unicode standard is more than that.
So what drove you then to implement that in TinyMux?
Adding a universal character set to TinyMux makes interfacing with some other software components easier, especially the web-related stuff. If the server needs to access certain kinds of external data, it's important that it has a way to represent that data. So that's the technical driver. The marketing-oriented driver is that the world is increasingly Unicode, and we need to move into that. There are competing online activities which offer Unicode, and people assume that all the new stuff has it, especially for something so closely tied to text. To really use Unicode in a text game, clients need to do some work too, so the situation's still young, but we need to start this. On an interpersonal level, it's easy to ask, but it isn't easy to ask someone where they're from or what they did today without using names and places in their own language. I know of citizens from China, from the PRC, who are using mushes as a way to gain English proficiency at a level that would be otherwise unavailable to them. I think this resource could be useful in both directions. Think of all the discussions which can now occur within a mush instead of needing external forums and URLs to external resources, like the overlap between anime fandom and mushdom, you know, that exists. Part of role-playing is being teleported out of your everyday life. Grids could now offer more accurate historical period information and for descriptions of foreign locations. You can add more realistic ambiance to what is otherwise an English-only game. But we may see more foreign language-only games, which may or may not include English at all. And this might open up our hobby to a wider pool of talent, from which may come our next generation of community and contributions.
So what is it like to actually use TinyMux right now and to use the Unicode features?
Well, it's fairly straightforward. There really isn't much to do. For game owners, the database format, the character set used by the database, is UTF-8. There's only one format. If we added any locale-specific features in the future, they would appear as parameters to softcode functions and not part of the database configuration. So the databases are still portable. You could begin a Spanish game and then turn around and have it end up being a French game. There's no dead ends there. Games that use only ASCII would only use the ASCII characters and would consume about the same amount of memory and run about the same speed as they do now. Clients will typically negotiate into UTF-8 and use Unicode characters in descriptions, poses, pages, mail, channel poses the same way as any other character. It's possible to generate those characters in-game with char and accent, although accent may be too limited for the job. In the near term, we do expect some turbulence for clients, so each connection to TinyMux will also use one of three character sets, ASCII, Latin-1, and UTF-8. If a client can do only ASCII, anything from the game in UTF-8 is approximated to their client in ASCII, or in the worst case, there's a substitution. We substitute a question mark. So if there's a Japanese character in the game and it's sent to a client that can only understand ASCII, they'll see a question mark.
This was obviously a major undertaking. How major? I mean, what was involved in the implementation on the hard code side?
It was a major undertaking. There was I expected it to be much harder, and I really wasn't prepared to do it until this point when we really had TinyMux 2.6 squared away and sort of a known quantity. So I was willing to take more risk in 2.7, and Unicode's a challenge I've been wanting to take on for a number of years now. The biggest decisions were choices up front. There's so many possibilities. So choosing how it would be encoded internally and anticipating how that would interact with other things like string manipulation, the network, and the database, those were the big decisions. Most of the platform APIs on Unix and Windows take a plain integer or their own native format, but I found that their responses were highly dependent on the locale settings, and while Windows would only accept a 16-bit integer, it claimed many, many more characters as printable than the same API on Unix with the same locale with 32-bit integer. It seemed to confuse the issue to reconcile all of the system APIs for the various platforms and try to make sense of that in conjunction with the Unicode standard. And then if you look at PCRE, the regular expression package for Perl compatible regular expressions, it has its own way of encoding Unicode properties. As it turned out, we did some initial profiling, and that pointed me in a different direction. Converting between encoding forms was taking 10 times longer than recognizing UTF-8 as it was, and that advantage did not even include calling an OS library call to classify the code point as printable or not. So I focused on building state machines that just recognize UTF-8 sequences. And to give you a rough idea of how much size that was, for 15 kilobytes, we're able to separate the 95,000 printable code points that we do want to accept from the million-plus code points that we don't want to accept. That seems like a perpetual motion machine to only use 15 kilobytes to express that, but that's the way it falls out. As ASCII characters, those are classified in one lookup, so there's no performance penalty for using ASCII characters. So we accept UTF-8, we keep it in UTF-8, we don't convert out of UTF-8, it's all UTF-8. So it's kind of strange that as important as code points are in understanding Unicode, in TinyMux, they never actually appear as integers anywhere except for the char and ord functions where they're required. All the idioms for classifying and transforming code points are implemented with compact table-driven state machines. The string layer was the most affected layer in TinyMux. Jake did some initial work drawing basic string behavior into a C++ class, and we had to re-implement that for Unicode, which caused him some turbulence. But it was much easier to do that than and keep the same interface, and the rest of the server was unaffected. The rest of the string layer was unaffected by the most part. On the client side, Sparks added some of the telnet options, charset environment, that helped to negotiate into UTF-8. Some of that really required some client-specific knowledge that Sparks had. The database conversion I expected to be much more difficult than it was. But most of the problem was getting started, understanding the standard, making those initial choices, and building the infrastructure that would make the string layer changes as easy as possible. There's another somewhat related and unrelated change we made at the same time, and that was to transform all of the ANSI color sequences to code points. The advantage is this eliminates all the naked escape characters from the database, and that prevents normal text from accidentally matching parts of the ANSI sequence. Probably enables in the future mixes of color and text to be matched as if they were all text. Representing them as code points is more compact. An ASCII sequence takes between 4 and 5 bytes, whereas a code point takes 3, and it simplifies the code because there's only one kind of coding that you do. Everything's a code point. So recognizing the presence of color is no longer requires a separate ANSI parser in with all of the string handling. It's just all the same thing.
So the last time we were chatting about this, you alluded to the fact that, there are sort of levels of Unicode implementation, and this is the first, perhaps the most important. But is there a next step, and if so, what would that be?
Yeah, the next step is there's no pressing urgency to implement the full Unicode standard this time. One reason is that the clients are kind of lagging behind, and it's going to require some transition anyway. But some of the next steps require client work. They need the fonts, and when they get Unicode string, they need to know how to deal with some of the Southeast Asian scripts where the code points interact. For the server side, the next step is to do proper normalization. Right now, the server is not aware of these things called grapheme clusters, which are sequences of code points that may contain combining characters, which we don't currently accept. You're supposed to manipulate those as a unit, so you'd never separate them. In a scramble call, all of those code points would scatter and be associated with the wrong base character, so we don't handle that right now. Eventually, once you accept the combining characters and do some of the Korean Hangul decompositions and compositions, you need the ability to put those strings back into a normalized form. Unicode calls that form the NFC form. So that we can do proper string comparison and make sure that functions that are defined can be accessed in all of the different equivalent ways. That's it. There's nothing else to do really after that. That's the full Unicode implementation.
I guess I'll just have to buy myself a new keyboard or something like that.
Well, operating systems do provide some help in this respect. They do have... Windows has language bars. There's quite a bit of material that can be copied and pasted in to clients when clients really support that. So it's not that bad. Also for Ambiance, you don't need a lot of material. You just need signage and that kind of stuff. So
when you're testing this out, what client are you using, and what language are you looking at?
Sparks is a Mac hound. She develops the Atlantis client, and Atlantis has gone back and forth with some of the server changes. So her goal is to support all of the options that the server negotiates. Aesthetically, it's really cool to see a Japanese snippet in the mix with what is otherwise English. I'm an anime fan. I watch a lot of anime, and to be able to search for to see someone pose the title of an anime flick, and to be able to copy that out and paste it in and search for it and find out more information about that title is cool. I like that.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for coming on the show. For this episode's visit to a mush, I spent a little time at Intermush, a multilingual mush that's all about language learning. It's got two goals. First, to be usable by anyone, no matter what language the user speaks. And second, to be a place where one can learn any language. The most dramatic thing about Intermush is that the whole mush, the messages generated by the server, most of the commands, the room descriptions, the interaction with objects, like a little hangman game I found, can be done in your choice of seven languages: English, Croatian, Spanish, Portuguese, German, French, or Dutch. Not only can you experience and extend the world in several languages, but Intermush has been scheduling live language lectures with players and staff volunteering to teach, I think it's Spanish and Croatian so far. These lectures are archived on the Mush, so you can catch up if you're coming in the middle of a series. They're in the process now of setting up virtual countries with air travel between them to enhance language learning with other cultural learning experiences. The head wizard there, well, I was going to say his name, but I think I'll let him say his name so that he'll get the pronunciation right after all of this language stuff. So the head wizard there,
Jurica Paljan,
is the leading Croatian translator for the Penmush server and has a really well-defined vision going on here. So if you're into language learning, you might want to take a look at Intermush.
Hi, this is Elvira, and you're listening to Tiny Talk, a podcast about mushes and the people who play them.
And now some news and notes. Chiaro Scuro, a mush at jointhesaga.com, would like to announce that it has added a new expansion to the mush called the Wildlands, including many more craftable items, two new races, a huge realm, and all kinds of other interesting goodies for the players of that mush, so check them out. Also, it'll be a few weeks between this episode and the next one, as I'm about to take a trip to the Philippines for a couple of weeks and really immerse myself in Tagalog. I'll keep my eyes and ears open for anything that might be interesting to the mush community while I'm there. And that's it for episode 2 of Tiny Talk. Music for this episode comes from David Aubryn's My Revolution album and jamindo.com. Show notes for Tiny Talk are at community.penmush.org. Look for the Tiny Talk icon on the right side of the screen. If you're downloading this directly from the web, you can also subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Store or with your favorite podcatcher. Tiny Talk is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license, so you're welcome to share it as is, as long as you don't sell it. If you have comments, mushing questions you'd like answered, news and notes, or suggestions for future shows, send email to tinytalk@javelin.penmush.org or leave a voicemail 206-666-5114 if you don't mind having it played back on the show. Until next time, keep the text flowing.